Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Well, hello. I'm Alice DeBoos and I'm a partner with Kingston Reid.
And I'm Duncan Fletcher. I'm also a partner with Kingston Reid.
In today's podcast, we are going to discuss the often controversial topic of enterprise bargaining and whether or not there are still benefits in the system or has it passed its use-by date. Someone, a wise person who may be joining me on this podcast, termed it, is enterprise bargaining dead or just resting its eyes? Duncan, no discussion about the current system of bargaining is complete without discussing the past and the whole purpose of enterprise bargaining when it was first introduced. So why don't you give us a potted history? How long have we had enterprise bargaining and what, from your perspective and understanding, was the original purpose?
And it's interesting because it actually originates as a labour slash unions concept, and that originates from the late 80s when the Accord had established a constraint around bargaining or around claims across the award system, and many unions were pushing for an ability to reach agreements that were beneficial to their members in specific enterprises. And that was also tied to the notion of union bargaining fees, which is a way of making increasing union revenue from the bargaining process. And one of the residual aspects of that is union claims around superannuation funds and other employer funds that they control as part of the bargaining process. But from that origin, the concept of union bargaining fees and a union-dominated bargaining system never really got off the runway because Keating lost the election in 1996, and with the arrival of Australian Workplace Agreements, that changed the dynamic. So now what we've got is a system of enterprise bargaining that, while it was kicked off by the union movement and they've sort of been part of it ever since, in the most recent reform, which was 2009, you've seen unions disconnected from the process and the original bargaining fee motivation for it has evaporated.
I mean, that idea of a collective bargaining agreement through its various iterations has been around now roughly for about 30 years in our legal system. How far do you think we've strayed from that original intent under the Fair Work Act, given that really originally the lofty goal was one of gaining productivity in return for better wages and conditions?
My perspective is that you sort of had a lofty goal, as you say, of mutually beneficial productivity gains and obviously side benefits for unions as managers of the process. And in the last 10 to 20 years, it's really boiled down to two basic questions. It's an ability to get away from award provisions. So where there's a perception of inflexibility in awards, it's about being able to do your own thing in your own business. That's number one. And number two is the ability to protect yourself from people taking industrial action. But interestingly, if you look at those two goals, goal one has basically been undermined by the application of the Better Off Overall test, because it's very hard to get an enterprise agreement that deviates too far from the award in terms of flexibility because of the line-by-line approach that's taken in assessing the Better Off Overall test. And in relation to strikes, many employers where there's limited productivity to be gained think that the cure of getting 4 years or up to 4 years of protection from strike action is actually the disease of strike action, the cure of having an enterprise agreement to try and get protection from that is worse than the disease. So a lot of people are saying, well, we've got the flexibility we need from the bargaining that we did 10 or 15 years ago. Those agreements are fine. It's very hard to terminate them. So we'll just walk away and rely on the fact that it's really difficult for unions to organise a workforce to go on strike.
It's kind of a necessity, isn't it? People have an enterprise agreement because they have to have one, rather than seeing these days anyone having one because they want to have one.
That's my experience. I mean, invariably, the goal of having an enterprise agreement is driven by other parties. So it's either banks who want this notion of a 4 years of no strikes, even though no one in Australia goes on strike anymore, or they want this notional idea of controlling the terms and conditions within their own workplace. But that's challenged as well, because the better off overall test means that really it's not a far cry from what's in the award, and awards are being stripped back anyway. So as an industrial instrument themselves, they're actually becoming quite competitive.
Yeah, yeah. I think that you're right. And the main issues that I hear from clients these days about enterprise bargaining, so the complaints about the system, if you like, they really just fall into two buckets. The first is the lack of any trade-offs or semblance of productivity gains. I mean, it's possible but not probable that you can go into a bargaining round and achieve any kind of dramatic change in terms of the way that your enterprise operates. And I think that that comes down to what I like to describe as the calcification of terms. These things are...
Oh, I like that, calcification.
I like it too. Yes. I envisage this... stalagmite, you know, and they just get kind of thicker and thicker and thicker with these layers of calcium as the years go on, because anyone who's been involved in doing an EA knows that it's really hard to change a single word, let alone a core condition, or to introduce something that might be novel or innovative or a real change in terms of work practices. Bargaining often gets bogged down in dealing with one or two items in an enterprise agreement, and they're generally not the core items in my experience. So you have
industrial plaque, you might say.
Industrial plaque, I like that one. That's exactly what it's like. You don't start with a fresh sheet of paper. You just play around the edges of a document that your business and the unions first came up with perhaps 10, maybe even longer, maybe 15, 20 years ago. So it doesn't...
Well, you've been involved in a lot of high-profile termination matters,
yeah.
and I guess if you want to extend the industrial plaque analogy, the termination application is a little bit like the drill, isn't it? Like enterprise bargaining
is the...
Exactly. Enterprise bargaining is sort of a bit like, you know, brushing your teeth with a dog-eared, you know, $2 Oral-B, whereas the big sort of big impact is it really requires those sort of those other levers like termination. And I'd view to get rid of that plaque.
Yeah, you need a new set of dentures.
It's all or nothing. It's on or off.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. And there needs to be a big seismic event, I think, to achieve that change. I'm not saying it needs to be conflict-driven all the time, but simple bargaining through rounds of enterprise agreements is not ever going to achieve any kind of seismic change. And I guess the second...
And what about the boot?
The boot.
The
boot is everyone's bugbear. I will give the Fair Work Commission and Member Assist some brownie points on at least having they have sped up the process recently, and that's been a good thing. But nonetheless, the law is the law, and the way that the boot operates, I don't think provides the flexibility that enterprise bargaining was designed to give. And for those of you who are a little more unfamiliar, the boot, as the better off overall test as currently constituted, means that you've got to apply that test to each and every worker who may be covered by the enterprise agreement. So, for example, if you trade off weekend penalty rates to give your Monday to Friday workers a much higher loaded hourly rate, it may not pass the boot if, in fact, the guy who only comes in for one shift on a Sunday is receiving a terms and conditions that might be lower than the applicable award. It doesn't matter that that's one person as opposed to the 3,000 people that work Monday to Friday. And that lack of flexibility makes enterprise bargaining as a concept, I think, very unappealing for many employers.
And ironically, I don't think that that's necessarily... You were asking about the history before, and in the original formulation of our enterprise bargaining, there was never a concept that everyone wins a prize and that no one would have their conditions changed individually to their detriment. And to pick up your example of the guy who works Sunday, that same guy can work other days of the week.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with the boot now is that the tail's wagging the dog. And I think we've seen that with some of the big retail agreements where you've had individuals intervening in the process, and also seen it with union interventions in agreement making.
And what do you see as the major issues that come to you with enterprise bargaining?
Exactly what I just mentioned. Individual intervention is something that I kind of understand. I can see why if you're an individual worker that's affected by an overall agreement, there should be an ability for you to raise your concerns about missing out as a result of that agreement. Having said that, it's a majority system. It's set up with a vote by a majority to put in place terms and conditions that will apply to
the
majority.
It's the beauty of democracy.
That's democracy. And it does seem a little bit alien to me that you go to all the trouble of getting a majority vote only to have one disgruntled individual who works on a Sunday, to use your example, who can then unpick the thing for everyone. Having said that, I do understand those individual concerns, and my view is that the Commission could address those if it had the power through some kind of take-home pay order, which was something that was talked about when modern awards were reformed, or some other fix at the individual level. So I think that's a separate issue. The one that really gets me worked up, though, is unions interfering in the making of enterprise agreements. And
at the approval stage.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, at all stages, but particularly at approval, and particularly where they haven't been involved in the negotiation process. So if you go back to 2009, the whole point of the Fair Work Act reforms were to remove unions as parties principal to the bargaining process, save for a specific exception, which was Greenfields agreements, where you've got no employees. But if we're talking about regular common or garden agreements that are renewed through the course of bargaining, the basic fundamental premise was unions and employer associations are not parties principal. It is between employers and employees, which is a completely natural way to do things. And in Western Australia, where I work predominantly, my experience has been that from 2009 onwards, a lot of employers embraced that and they did their own thing. And I think I can comment that because of our history in this market, union density was a lot lower. The industries we worked in had low union density, and employers and employees just got on with it. And there were a lot of agreements made from 2009 onwards that were employer-employee agreements exactly as the Fair Work Act had contemplated. Now, unfortunately, that then led to unions experiencing a loss of market share, and it's produced in the last couple of years just this bloody-minded approach where through the Commission applying an overly rigorous and technical interpretation of the approval requirements and the better off overall test issues that you've just talked about, what we've ended up with is a system where an employer and employees do all the hard work to get an agreement in place that suits them, that's competitive, it's got competitive terms and conditions, and then all a union needs to do is turn up at the end, say that they are the custodians of the award and the protectors of employees who might be affected by enterprise agreements, point to a technicality and scuttle an agreement. So basically just kill off an agreement where an employer and employee has done all the work. Now, if an employer has to spend all the money, do all the work to get an agreement in place, and all the union needs to do is file an objection, which costs virtually nothing, and let the Commission knock over an agreement on a technicality, something is wrong. And that's the facilitator of the plaque. That's basically, let's stretch the plaque analogy, that's mainlining picnic bars. You're going to get lots of plaque growing in those circumstances where the means of getting an agreement is completely stymied by parties who, because of their lack of density in the industry, have had nothing whatsoever to do with bargaining.
And I think it's important to note there, because I completely agree with that point, that this is not about a lack of oversight or dodgy agreements getting up without anyone having the opportunity to review. That's not what it's about here. Because what I think is very common is that you'll get an intervention at that approval stage that absolutely has no basis, and ultimately their objection will be thrown out. But in the process, there's this enormous delay to employees. Let's face it, employees who did not choose to be represented by that union. I mean, I had a case that took 18 months through appeals, or went all the way to the federal court, came back down, full benches, first instance on two different occasions to get an agreement approved, when there was nothing wrong with the process, nothing wrong with the agreement. But those employees had to wait 18 months for that agreement to be approved, that agreement that they voted on. So I completely agree that there does need to be some change or some reform to the way that objections are dealt with at the last minute.
That's right. And I think it's the FOMO principle. Basically, it's fear of missing out.
Yeah.
Objectors are objecting because their name's not on the agreement. And like you, I've had similar experiences where in the oil and gas industry, clients of, or a client in particular, put together a cutting edge industry leading agreement. The only reason why the particular union objected was because their name wasn't on the agreement and they weren't getting the market share and the kudos for negotiating such a good deal.
Yeah.
That seems to me to be broken, particularly when they've got this privileged position of being default bargaining representatives. You've got the position, but my perception is there's a lack of resources or a laziness about using that privilege.
Well, what about greenfields agreements where unions play an important and fundamental role? You work in a state where there are absolute mega projects that will go on for many, many, many years. Do you think that the provisions around the making of greenfields agreements as currently constituted meets the needs of industries?
In a word, no. And look, I actually blame the Howard government for creating this problem, because they pre Fair Work Act, during Work Choices, they introduced the notion of the employer greenfields agreement.
Yes. Which was I'll do an agreement with myself.
That's right. The onanistic agreement. The employer greenfields agreement was a very, very greedy bit of legislating and was always going to upset people. But I've often described the employer greenfields agreement as the crack cocaine of enterprise agreements. And it came in 2005 during the peak of the last iron ore expansion in Western Australia. And in that environment, employers, through the sort of careful programming of work and allocation of work to subcontractors, were able to basically lock the unions completely out of any form of agreement making for those major projects. They still got very generous conditions because the market required generous conditions. And people will remember the construction workers with all of various boats and holiday houses and other accoutrements of being in major construction. And none of that was gained through unions negotiating agreements. So I think that really, one, it upset the union movement, and I think unfairly, they shouldn't have been put in that position. But two, it also banks and project developers and people who sign off on projects, they got addicted to the idea that you can get a year with no strikes. And that after Fair Work, when that was changed so that those agreements could only be obtained from a union and only for a nominal term of 4 years, that became what those project proponents and financiers wanted. And that then created further problems, because the projects that followed were the LNG projects, and they are mega, mega projects. So they are projects where a four-year term will not go the distance. So that created two problems. First problem, the only way you could get the agreement, you couldn't do it with yourself anymore, so you had to find someone to do it with, and the only person that you could do it with under the Fair Work Act was the union. So, of course, if there's only one person you can get an agreement with and you desperately want an agreement,
the price
of that agreement is going to be very high. Exactly. So you're dealing with high cost agreements, and the LNG agreements were extremely generous in the first part of this decade. The second issue is that 4 years of protection from strike action wasn't long enough. So on Gorgon, on impacts on Wheatstone, the big LNG projects. You had major contractors who ran out of term. They hit their expiry on their enterprise agreements mid-project, and unions were then mobilised, ready to bargain, and obviously able to use their strike powers in negotiating new conditions. End result, they gouged an even higher price. So you look at the cost of those mega projects, and it's just, it's unbelievable. And I think the one that's on the horizon in your neck of the woods is the Western Sydney Airport.
Yeah.
And this is an issue that I think the government's got to get sorted out before that project really gets underway.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a moment, actually, what proposals may flow out of the working groups, which have just wrapped up. But before we move on to that, I think another issue that's worth a little bit of attention is compliance. Now, compliance with EAs keeps you and I busy, but I readily concede it's a big problem and not an ideal issue for employers with EAs to be dealing with. Because of the difficulty associated with changing these documents, I find that they're usually, in fact, nearly always, really badly drafted, because what will happen is that they're drafted in bits and pieces by different people over many, many, many years. So no one has the ability, because of the way that we bargain in this country, to sit down and start with a blank sheet of paper and say, let's work out what each and every clause means. So, you know, your cross-referencing doesn't work, the terminology used is different, the defined terms don't make sense. Is that something that you experience as well?
Absolutely. So what I see is, I call them vulture claims on big projects. So there'll be these agreements that are done en masse in circumstances that I was describing before, where it's necessary for the project to obtain certainty. It's usually drafted by an employer association. It's usually drafted with a mind to just getting the thing sorted and making sure that there's protection from strike action. And the end result is that at the end of the project, a union, even if it's not the union that's involved, so it might be that AWU did the agreement for the project, and then the CFMEU turns up and says, oh, hey, clause X, that says that you were supposed to be paid while you were travelling between the gate and the crib huts, but you guys were never paid that while you're on site. And then that produces all these massive back pay and underpayment type claims. So the net result of that is that I've got a lot of clients who now, where they can avoid it, and given the constraints of the better off overall test, they see that the award, there's a fair bit of jurisprudence around how the award clauses work.
Yep.
And so sometimes they're taking the view that, you know, the award is better the devil you know.
And I always recommend clients, whenever there's an argument, run each and every one down and get an agreed meaning. And if you can't agree a meaning, get it arbitrated, because it'll save you money in the long run and save confusion. And what I love to see, if it's possible to do it in a particular bargaining context, is I say, when you sit down to do your EBA, before anything is put to a vote, sit down with the union, and it might be that you sit down with their industrial officer or the person who's actually drafting the bloody thing. Sit down with them and agree on a table what each and every clause actually means. And together
agree. An explanatory memorandum for an agreement.
Yep.
Is that the idea?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because firstly, it should stop any arguments that then happened during the life of the agreement, because everyone around the table has got an agreed meaning. But if you're unfortunate enough to then still have an argument down the track, with the lawyer hat on, you've got some brilliant evidence about what was actually agreed as to the meaning of the clause. Now, I don't want to go into the jurisprudence about interpretation of EAs, but just that exercise will save a lot of money and a lot of time, and it will assist with your compliance, because that's a document, your explanatory memorandum, which is a good way of describing it, that you could give to your payroll.
Yeah, absolutely.
To help them plug in the payroll rules so that you don't end up on the front page of the Fin with an underpayment due to a payroll system around EA clause interpretation.
Or make a virtue of the genuine agreement arguments and make it part of the explanation process.
Absolutely.
So that absolutely everyone's on the same page. That's a really neat idea, and it actually... I think the beauty of it is that it gets you to reset as well, I'm thinking, because you might have a really old provision that's subject to the industrial plaque or calcification that you were talking about before.
Yeah.
It's been there for a million years. You can almost, there's an opportunity to reset when you make a new agreement, even if it's an old provision, on what the meaning is as at today.
Totally. Because
that's the other issue, of course, is that meanings change over time.
Yeah, they do. They do. So after all that criticism, do you think it's utopian to expect that the system as it currently stands can deliver EAs that meet the needs of employers and employees? Or is that just pie in the sky stuff?
Look, I think
I should put my hook and pipe down.
Yeah, I think it can. I think I've been disappointed with the government's working group process, because I think the working group process, having closed door confidential meetings with employer groups and unions, was always going to produce a impasse, because they are the exact forces that are creating the calcification that you were talking about before. But like you, I don't think you can be an armchair critic. I think you've got to come up with ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think with that in mind, you know, I think we should ask ourselves, well, I'll ask you, if there was a couple of things that you could do, what would they be?
One would be harking back to what we talked about in relation to union intervention in approval process, make it a reverse onus. At the moment, the unions rock up and they say, oh, it wasn't genuinely agreed. And you go, well, yeah, it was. And they say, no, it wasn't. And you say, have you got any evidence? And the Act and the Commission will say to you, well, actually, employer, it's your job to disprove that. I think that's us about. I think that there should be a reverse onus for union intervention.
That's a great idea. And the other option is make standing really strictly applied for agreements. So the Commission uses its Section 590 power to generally inform itself, to let unions in and be heard in agreements that they've had absolutely nothing to do with. I think if you put a reverse onus constraint on the exercise of 590, and the other thing that I think would help is if you had some sort of limitation on appeal, because the other thing I'm experiencing is that Fair Work Commission members at first instance are generally disposed to approving agreements if they think that they're going to move things along.
Yeah.
It's on appeal where the trouble is occurring. Now, in the unfair dismissal system, appeals to a full bench are restricted. Why can't we restrict appeals to a full bench in the agreement making sense as well? For example, why couldn't you make it so that you can appeal the non-approval of an agreement, because that's obviously in the interest of the employers and the employees, but the approval of an agreement cannot be appealed. What's wrong with that?
What about you?
Okay, that's one. Is it my turn?
Yeah, it's your turn.
All right, okay. Look, this is a bit of a... This one's a little bit of a sidebar, but it's an important sidebar. So I've been going on for a long time about individual flexibility agreements. Individual flexibility agreements are part of bargaining.
Most people would say, what? What?
Well, they might. because they're the Jan Brady of industrial relations. They're the forgotten instrument. And I think they need to be given their time to shine. And it's not the union message is, oh, employers are trying to reintroduce Australian Workplace Agreements and individual contracts and statutory individual contracts, and it's all about getting rid of the collective. Well, I think the perfect answer to that is the individual flexibility agreement, which is born out of an award, which is collective, or an enterprise agreement, which is collective. One simple change, and I've actually looked at the change, and I think it requires, I think it's a total of 10 words to be added to one of the provisions of the Fair Work Act, to simply state that you can't take strike action if you're on an individual flexibility agreement that has not been terminated. Now, that, as an extension of bargaining and as a way of getting rid of the calcification, would be fantastic, because you give employers and employees another alternative.
Yeah.
An alternative that then makes the bargaining system more competitive. If you can say to an employee, these are really good terms and conditions, if they suit you, you've still got the protection of the collective, either through the award or through the enterprise agreement. But if you want to do your own thing, you can do it in individual flexibility agreement. You'll probably get paid more than what's on the collective arrangement. But the quid pro quo, the price for being there, is you have to commit to not going on strike while that is applying. Now, I think that suggestion completely invigorates the bargaining system and I don't think the unions can criticise that as an introduction of a statutory individual contract, because it's already there.
Yeah.
All we're doing is saying you can't go on strike if you've got one.
Yeah.
So I think that's one that's worth thinking of as a sort of left field idea. Mm. Okay, your turn.
I think two very simple amendments relating to Greenfields agreements could fix some of the issues that you discussed. So changing it to an 8-year term for mega projects. Obviously, there'd need to be some criteria around that, but that would be a sensible move. And I think that's got some traction with the working group. So we'll probably see that in the omnibus bill that's been flagged. I also think that changing the current 6-month notice period for employer-initiated Greenfields agreements back to 3 months would also be extremely helpful, because it's obviously not a Greenfields agreement once you turn the soil, and 6 months is a very long time.
The Greenfields are getting pretty brown by the time six months of grey
by that stage. So changing that to 3 months would be helpful. Back to you.
Okay, I reckon... This one's a bit of a tweak, but I think it would be very valuable to stop this interference issue we were talking about before. I think you could amend the Act very simply to give employers a protection from industrial action or strikes from the time an agreement is made, not from the time it is approved.
And for dummies, so what does that mean?
What it means is an agreement at the moment doesn't afford strike protection to employers until it is approved by the Fair Work Commission, which means that an appeal process to interfere with the making of it, the approval of an agreement, means that it can go on and on and on, and the employer gets no protection. If the matter is resolved so that when the agreement is voted up, in other words, made, that protection immediately starts, regardless of what the outcome is on approval, then unions are disincentivized to interfere with the process, because employers have got what they want. They've got that protection up front, and then they can make contingencies to deal with the interference in the approval process, but they've got that certainty that they need from the time that the agreement's made.
Yep.
All right, last one for you. I'm going to give the last suggestion to you.
I've left the last being the most difficult. I think we've got to fix the boot. Bring back the no disadvantage test or some other hybrid. I know that's high on the government's agenda, or at least it was high on the working group's agenda. So I don't think it'll get overlooked. I don't know whether it'll change, but it certainly was something that was high on their agenda. So we may see some change in the omnibus bill to come, but watch this space. So to wrap up, I guess regardless of the issues we've discussed, it's still absolutely the case that we will generally recommend that an enterprise agreement is often the best option for an employer for a whole host of reasons. And they will be generally reasons because born out of necessity. It's the only statutory means to amend the terms of an award where the employer does need some flexibility, or it's a necessity to protect against industrial action in particular industries and to win particular types of work in particular industries. So from your perspective, as a parting piece of commentary, do you agree, and can we make the current system work?
Yeah, I think I think we can. And look, we have made it work. We've had success with clients. It's just been expensive and time consuming to get to the end result, which is not good, because it's a drag on productivity across the economy generally. But I think the secret is to bypass the vested interests because they are running the arguments about enterprise bargaining at the moment. At the moment, you've got extremes on both sides. So there are a lot of unions want to see enterprise bargaining die because they want to see industry-wide bargaining, because that suits their long-term strategies. And there's a lot of employer associations who want to see enterprise bargaining die because they think if they kill enterprise bargaining, they will kill the unions. I disagree with that, but that's their view. Having said all of that, I think that as we've done since 2009, you've just got to make it work, because as you rightly point out, you still need flexibility in a lot of cases, and in a lot of cases you need protection from industrial action. So I think what it boils down to is dealing with a technical process and achieving the outcome that works for your business. And really it's three simple principles. Plan well in advance, know what you're doing, and the suggestions like your explanatory memorandum idea, all of those additions are what's needed to make things work well. So plan in advance and use your lawyers and advisors to make sure that you keep up to date on the mistakes of other people. So every week there'll be a new decision from the Commission that highlights some technical error that someone's made to prevent an agreement from being approved. Lawyers and advisors are the people who are on top of that stuff. They've got their fingers on the pulse and they can help you find ways to deal with those issues. So keep up to date with your advisors and also think about innovative ideas like the explanatory memorandum, like bargaining grids. And basically, it's not, enterprise bargaining is not just a job for the personnel department anymore. It's got to have
totally.
Technical experts involved. And the final one, and this is a one that I always think is important, is always have a plan B. And sometimes a plan C and a plan D. Never ever work on the enterprise bargaining agreement outcome as your sole and only outcome. There must be a plan B.
Yeah. And I would completely echo that theme as my last point. The enterprise bargaining agreement is a tool which is important and useful for those that require it. There's no possibility that they're going to be abolished in the medium term. So if you have to do one, then get the most out of it. It strikes me that wages are often the largest expense in a business, which means that your EA is one of the most important commercial documents that you'll enter into for the period of it. So say it's a 3-year EBA, this could be one of your most important commercial agreements for 3 years. Yet the EA doesn't receive the same type of attention that another commercial deal with the costs attached to it would within a company. But it's not just a commercial document, it's one that can assist in shaping the culture of the working environment. But how often do we see employers hand over the control and the narrative of that important document to a union? And I'm by no means saying this as any kind of anti or pro-union narrative. I'm just saying that employers often don't take ownership of the enterprise agreement and control the narrative and really campaign, as you say, plan and prepare your enterprise agreement so that it works for you. At the end of the day, if you've got to have one, you've got to have one that works for you, and you've got to have one that you've given your best shot to shape to the needs of the business. Great to have this chat, and we really hope you enjoyed it.
Likewise.